From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, The Wire, we meet the HBO series creator David Simon and writer-producer George Pelicanos. The Wire has been called a television show that thinks it's a novel, and that's appropriate, since George Pelicanos is an acclaimed crime writer with a dozen hard-boiled books to his credit. David Simon started his career as a police reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Also, the World Series of Poker, we meet poker pro Phil Gordon. He co-hosts the high-stakes TV show on Bravo. And Milo Miles reviews a new album of Stephen Foster cover tunes, and critic John Powers tells us all about political blogs. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraqi Interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi assured a joint meeting of Congress today that his government is succeeding despite what he called setbacks and a tough struggle. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Far more Republicans than Democrats went to hear the Iraqi leader, who told them the U.S. decision to go to war in Iraq was the right one.
My friends, today we are better off, you are better off, and the world is better off without Saddam Hussein.
Alawi promised elections will be held in Iraq in January, though Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told a Senate panel later they may not be held in areas racked by violence. Delaware Democratic Senator Joseph Biden said too little effort's been made to stop that violence.
There obviously has been a decision not to use the full force available to us to go in to Fallujah, Samaria, and other places to root out the insurgents.
Biden warned American support for Iraq may fade if insurgents are not stopped. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Senator John Kerry challenged Alawi's assertion that Iraq is making progress on the road to elections. The Democratic presidential candidate noted that insurgents control some key Iraqi cities.
The United States and the Iraqis have retreated from whole areas of Iraq. There are no-go zones in Iraq today. You can't hold an election in a no-go zone.
Senator Kerry campaigned today in Ohio. As Hurricane Jean slowly makes its way toward the Bahamas, Florida officials are keeping a close eye on the storm. Jean, with winds of more than 100 miles per hour, could make landfall somewhere along the southeastern coast this weekend. Zach Seidenberg reports from Florida Public Radio.
Meteorologist Ben Nelson says Hurricane Jean is sitting about 600 miles to the east of West Palm Beach, Florida, and drifting westward. He says portions of the northwest Bahamas are already under a hurricane watch, but adds Jean's track remains uncertain.
We do expect a gradual northwestward and northward turn, but given the uncertainties that we have right now, this could take a Francis-type track where it goes all the way across the peninsula, or we could see something that hugs the east coast and turns northwards.
Nelson says as the forecasts are updated, Florida is looking more and more vulnerable. He says tropical storm force winds could spread on shore in southeast Florida as early as Saturday. For NPR News, I'm Zach Seidenberg in Tallahassee.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 70 points to close at 10,038 in active trading of nearly 1.3 billion shares. Declines led advances by about 9 to 7. The Nasdaq gained a fraction to close at 1886. This is NPR News. Florida's Supreme Court has unanimously overturned a law that was keeping a severely brain-damaged woman connected to a feeding tube. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports from Miami.
The Florida legislature hastily passed Terry's law last fall under the urging of Florida Governor Jeb Bush. The bill was named for Terry Schiavo, a woman who's been in a persistent vegetative state for more than 10 years. The law prevented Michael Schiavo, Terry's husband, from removing his wife's feeding tube. That overruled lower courts, which had decided that Michael had the right to make decisions on his wife's behalf. Terry Schiavo did not leave a living will, and her parents insist that she could still regain consciousness someday. Now the Florida High Court has said that the state legislature violated the separation of powers when it intervened. Chief Justice Barbara Pariente wrote, "It is without question an invasion of the authority of the judicial branch for the legislature to pass a law that allows the executive branch to interfere with the final judicial determination in a case. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Miami.
A new government report says investigators were able to slip weapons and explosives past security screeners at 15 U.S. airports last year. Representative John Mica, a Florida Republican, called the report a horrific wake-up call.
The inspector general has found that there are problems with technology, there are problems with training, and there are problems with management and administration in TSA. Unfortunately, that results in not very good detection of either weapons or explosives.
Mica chairs a House subcommittee on aviation. The Transportation Security Administration says many of the problems mentioned in the report have already been resolved. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment. At visa.com/signature.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The HBO drama series The Wire, which is set in Baltimore and looks at the respective activities and hierarchies of cops and criminals, has just begun its third season. It's gotten lots of critical acclaim. The San Francisco Chronicle calls it the best show on television, period. But it doesn't enjoy the high profile of other HBO shows, like The Sopranos and 6 Feet Under. David Simon, the creator of The Wire, may be a little disappointed in that, but he's not surprised. Every step of the way, he's designed his show to go against normal conventions of the genre. Simon's unflinching, realistic approach to television has attracted some respected novelists, including George Pelicanos, Richard Price, and Dennis Lehane, whose enthusiasm for The Wire has led them to write for the show. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk to David Simon and George Pelicanos. David Simon was a police reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He took a leave of absence to write a book documenting a year in the life of the city's homicide squad. That book, Homicide: A Year on the Killing Streets, was the basis for the brilliant NBC series Homicide: Life on the Street. The Wire is his third series. All three have been set and filmed in Baltimore. Crime novelist George Pelicanos is the Washington, D.C. counterpart to David Simon. His books include The Sweet Forever and Hard Revolution. All 12 of his books are set there and based on lots of firsthand research and experience about the streets and people of D.C. He joined The Wire early and is now on staff as a writer and producer. Let's start with a scene from the third season premiere of The Wire, which HBO is showing through Saturday. Stringer Bell, the second-in-command drug lord, played by Idris Elba, has been to business school and returns with some new techniques for protecting the gang's turf and profits. He holds a sort of business seminar to explain his ideas to his skeptical followers.
How are we going to stand up some corner that's not ours?
Well, we got the best product, right? So the chances are we're going to be able to bring in the competition by offering the re-up with us from our package. Feel me? Everybody making money sharing the real estate. Slim Charles.
But what if they don't cop our re-up, though?
Well, I'm going to worry about that when it happens. Until then, Mr. Charles, we're going to handle this like businessmen. Sell the make the profit, and later for that gangster bullshit.
When you were planning The Wire in the beginning, David, and trying to figure out what sort of a visual style you wanted it to have, what sort of things did you reject? What sort of things were you adamant that you wanted it to look like?
I only had one rule, and Bob Colesbury incorporated into what he did. It really was his template. I guess I should start with that template. He didn't want it to reflect the jumpiness of sort of televised cop shows. I thought Homicide broke real ground visually with what they did with 16mm handheld and, you know, the jump cuts and everything. And I thought NYPD Blue with their sort of swish pans and rack focus and all that. What they did created a whole sort of style for the 90s, but it was stylistic, and it served stories that were heavily character-based. And one of the things that I wanted The Wire to be was a story told in its own time. we were very conscious of the fact that our story moves more slowly than the average episodic drama because we're not going to pay off at the end of the hour. We're going to pay off at the end of 12. And so we know we're starting in a very laconic poise, and we're going to go at our own speed, and we're going to revel in detail. And if that's the case, then the camera work has to reflect that. So we wanted more languid movements. We wanted the background to show great detail. You know, you can watch these episodes 2 and 3 times. You'll pick up stuff in the background every single time. It's made for DVD viewing because we're actually thinking on 2 or 3 levels. It's not, we're not just rushing background by. It's not just walk-bys. There's usually something going on in the scene visually. And similarly, we didn't want the camera to have any advanced knowledge of the story. Since we're asking viewers to follow the story very carefully and to pick up facts as they go along and never to have more facts than we're allowing, it's sort of unfair to have the camera be fishing and be finding things that only the camera would know is there. So a lot of the pans and the camera moves that were sort of typical of, you know, the last generation of cop shows really wouldn't work for The Wire. You know, when the camera moves somewhere, it's because a character looked over there or referenced something in dialogue. There's no unmotivated camera movement. And that's very different from what sort of, you know, everything has become so stylized in American television. We were really going back to sort of a very basic filmic logic.
From the second season, when you were down on the harbor, what were the visual opportunities, first of all, that you got that made The Wire look so distinctive last year? And how hard was that to pull off?
First of all, we needed the cooperation of the Port Authority in Maryland, and they were very gracious about hosting us. But it was something that Bob seized on right away. We had talked about the idea of doing something that captured the working class struggle that was going on with unionized workers in Baltimore. And we talked about the GM plant, Beth Steele, which was going bankrupt at the time. But there's something about those cranes. They're so beautiful and gothic. And just looking at them, standing over the harbor, they imply work. They imply the power of the city-state. They're like cathedrals. They're like steeples in the center of the town. And when they're idle, it seems to be an editorial comment. And when they're working, it seems to be an editorial comment. And so it was wonderful to frame it around the port. I don't think anyone spent any time on a port doing any storytelling since maybe On the Waterfront. And if you have the opportunity to watch that movie again, that movie crackles. And that, of course, was a time of bulk cargo, so you didn't even have all the equipment. There was just something about it that spoke to work and lost opportunities and a way of being that was dying. And it's dying in the neighborhood where I live. I mean, you know, more and more yuppies, more and more $300,000 homes, but the old Polish stevedore families are moving out.
There's also the sense last year that we were making a visual record of the city that was going away. And in fact, a lot of places that we filmed and the things that you see in that season, they're gone already.
This is the third season of The Wire now. Can you delineate the differences between seasons 1 and 2 in just overall themes and what you're trying to do this year with the show?
Okay. Season 1 began a theme that I think will continue throughout the run of the show, which is the nature of institutions in modern culture and how individuals are affected by the institutions that they serve or are supposed to serve them. There was also an argument being made about the efficacy of the drug war in the first season. The second season expanded our facsimile of a post-industrial city of our make-believe Baltimore to include the port and what's become of the working class and basically the death of work in a country that no longer makes anything, no longer manufactures anything or uses a port to ship it out. And what's happened to those unions and those workers and those Americans. This next season, we've returned to the theme of the drug war to do something very different, which is to examine the nature of reform. And we've expanded the city once again to include a political element. We wanted to look at the idea of what reform is and what it isn't and who might genuinely be a reformer and who might not and what the possibilities are for a culture that I think is actually increasingly disenfranchised when it comes to democracy. So there's a political element there. There's also a sub-theme working, which is there's a there's a drug war that I think people will find a certain amount of metaphor for what's happening in Iraq if they follow it carefully. So there's sort of two things going on at once. And I guess to give away a little bit more than that, there is we're asking a question about what would happen if one commander in one precinct in one American city decided to surrender in the drug war.
Mm-hmm.
What might actually happen?
Let me ask you a question, not of you two as writers, but you two as producers. If you care so much about telling a realistic story, how hard is it to cast realistically and then to film realistically?
We tend to like a lot of faces that you don't see on TV. I remember the first season of Homicide, Tom said with some great pride, and I think it was a little bit insulting to our actors, he said with great pride that he thought he had the ugliest show on network television. and by standards, he was probably correct, although there were a lot of very attractive people in that cast. I don't necessarily think our show is ugly or not, I think our show genuinely reflects a variety of people, which is what you find on the streets of Baltimore. And I'm very conscious of that. You know, if at some point everybody starts looking rigorously beautiful, it throws me out of my belief that I'm actually writing about a real place. I have problems looking at those dailies. You know, I don't want anybody to look, you know, torn down completely. But part of what made The Corner credible is not just that we took some very attractive people like, you know, Candy Alexander or Sean Nelson and tore them down a little bit, especially, you know, Candy, to get those performances. Mm-hmm. But we surrounded them with a lot of people that we cast in Baltimore, you know. And we'll go into a neighborhood and we'll be shooting and the SAG extras will show up and they'll look a little bit too, extra-like. They'll look like SAG extras. And so we'll send the ADs around to grab up people who are watching the filming who look much more credible because, you know what, they live in Baltimore. They actually live on those streets. And some of them actually, upon giving the opportunity, turn out to be pretty good actors. So it's not to say that this isn't being done by professionals, because it is. I mean, the vast majority of our major roles are cast in the usual fashion. But we're very conscious that we're trying to represent a place that is real and idiosyncratic. And so I think we look for idiosyncratic looks and performances. I think that's something that matters to us.
David Simon and George Pelicanos, writers and producers of the HBO crime series, The Wire. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with George Pelicanos, a writer-producer on The Wire, and David Simon, who created the show. There's something that you put in your book, in the Wire, Truth Be Told book, in your introduction, that a story that I hadn't heard about the audition tape by Dominic West, who plays McNulty.
Oh, that was beautiful. We had trouble casting McNulty. We had a lot of trouble casting him. It was. We were all over the map. We wanted a guy who had a little bit of the rogue in him, but we also wanted to have a guy who was, he could play scenes without. There was a lot that the character was not going to be able to explain. He was going to have to play his cards close to the vest. He's got to be a manipulative character, and at the same time, nobody was reading right for it. And this tape comes over the transom from England. Dominic had put himself on tape. He had his girlfriend hold the camera as he worked on his accent, and as she tried to avoid her accent while reading him the lines, they were basically cracking each other up. So he had to basically have her head out of the room. And so there was nobody to read lines to him. He didn't have a casting office. He didn't have a casting. It was... if you can imagine this, it was McNulty reads a line, stares into the void, waits for, you know, the appropriate amount of time for the line to come back to him, reacting to the line you don't hear, and then says his next line. So we watched the tape for about 25 seconds, and then Colesbury and I fell on the floor laughing. And then Clark Johnson, who was directing the pilot, came in, and he joined us on the floor. And it was like, what is this guy doing? You know, but, you know, after we stopped laughing, we took a look at what he was doing and even reacting to lines that weren't there. And we realized, this guy's a good actor. Yeah,
if he can do that, imagine.
If he can pull this off, you know, God knows what he can do in a room with another actor. And so we had him come over from England. I guess within a couple of days, we were reading him in New York under better circumstances.
George, if I can ask you a question about television that you were watching in this genre, and I'll throw the same question to David afterwards. It seems like you're both so clear on what you want The Wire to be, but also so clear on what you want it not to be. Can you talk about some of the programs that are on television now or have been on recently in the police or police procedural genre that drive you crazy?
Go get him, George. Go get him.
Oh, this was a good question? This is a softball with a seam?
No, I'm just thinking, you know. you're never going to work for them anyway. Go ahead.
No, I wouldn't name shows specifically. I mean, I'm definitely not going to name The District on CBS. It's one show I'm not going to talk about here. I think it's the general idea of, you know, it seems like every time you see, for example, you know, drug dealers in a cop show, they're bad through and through, and they're in the show to elevate the cops, to make the cops seem pure and so on. And it's this notion of good and evil and the quest for, you know, I'm going to get that guy, even if I have to throw my badge on your desk, Sarge, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some good, very good cop shows that were kind of, milestones, Hill Street Blues, the early NYPD Blue. I think these are fantastic shows, but you got to go back further. Is when I was a kid, I used to watch a show like The Twilight Zone, and you knew right away when you were watching it that there was something going on there in the writing, even though you had no idea what, you know, how a TV show worked, how it got up on screen. And I remember looking at, always waiting for the credits to see who wrote the episode, because it was real writers. It was people, you know, Serling came out of Playhouse 90. You had people like Richard Matheson writing. And I never understood why television didn't go after novelists and playwrights to write these shows, because we haven't been trained in a certain way. We just try to, for the most part, I can't speak for everybody, but we're just trying to you know, leave something behind that's worthwhile. And that's where this all came about. It's like, well, I was really into the fact that David wanted to try this experiment, because it's something that I really wondered why it hadn't been done before.
George, just to follow up on The District, because you are famous for your Washington, D.C. novels. So
yeah.
Here's a series that's set in that district. So you're telling me that when you watched it, you found something that may have bothered you in terms of its verisimilitude?
The idea that, you know, the District of Columbia needs a great white hope to come in and clean up the city and take it away from all those, you know, those Negroes that are ruining everything there. It goes back to, you know, I mean, it goes back to Birth of a Nation, basically. And for them to make a show like that in these, you know, at this point in our history is just, it's mind-boggling.
And David, your opinion of today's crime television?
You know, this is going to sound a little bit pompous, but if I had to write a police procedural, I would just put my head on a railroad track and wait for the train. It's a police procedure to me, having covered it for years. It's basically what's in the toolbox, you know, to make something seem real and to tell a story that is credible. It's not the be-all and end-all. It's not what I care to write about. It's not what I think matters to society or the culture as a whole. In truth, you know, how crimes get solved is cops go out on the street and they talk to other people. That's how crimes get solved. You know, the science of it is grandly overstated, particularly in urban areas that don't have money to create exacting police labs. It's not, you know, the finer points of law don't enter into the vast majority of criminal prosecutions in this country. It is an assembly line. And what I'm much more interested in than a crime story is the story of the city, is what's happened to American cities at the millennium, is what's been, you know, the wire's about what's been left behind in America. It's not about good guys or bad guys. It's not, you know, we wanted to be subversive to the extent that you think you're watching a show about whether they're going to catch the bad guy or not. By the time you get halfway through a season, you start realizing the idea of a bad guy has less meaning than you thought it did.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not they catch him is not the point. The point is that the system's dysfunctional. And we're really making an argument. It's a very angry show about a policy that I think has gone awry. And I'm somebody very sympathetic to good police work, having written Homicide. But the drug war has gone hideously awry. It's become a war against the underclass in this country. And it doesn't work on a practical level in places like Baltimore. So we're sort of interested in having a political dialectic and a social and an economic dialectic. And that matters more to me than whether or not they, you know, pluck the right fiber from the carpet and you know, the detective gets to call the bad guy into the room and you know, and bust him.
Mm-hmm.
I got no love of that. And so anybody who's going to approach it as a crime story purely probably shouldn't be writing for The Wire. You know, I'm really sort of hunting people who are using the genre of crime to say larger things.
All right. Well, David Simon, George Pelicanos, thanks for the great television. Thanks for the great conversation. Thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David Simon and George Pelicanos, writer-producers of HBO's The Wire. The third season started this week. The first season will be out on DVD, finally, on October 12th. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon, walk the straight and narrow track. If you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. You gotta keep the devil way down in the hole. He's got the fire and the fury at his command. Well, you don't have to worry if you hold on to Jesus' hand. We'll all be safe from Satan when the thunder rolls.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From Bantam Paperbacks, publisher of A Place of Hiding, the new Inspector Linley mystery novel set on the island of Guernsey by Elizabeth George. By Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. And from Alfred A. Knopf, publisher of The Love Wife by Gish Jen, author of Mona in the Promised Land. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Texas Hold'em and Omaha High-Low. We meet poker pro Phil Gordon. He's the host of Celebrity Poker Showdown on Bravo. Also, the music of Stephen Foster. A new album features contemporary musicians playing songs written in the 19th century. And John Powers comments on the increasing importance of political blogs.
Ah!
This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley. In the last 15 years, venerated American songwriters from Woody Guthrie to Cole Porter have been given makeovers by contemporary rock, pop, jazz, and folk performers. Now it's Stephen Foster's turn, with the collection Beautiful Dreamer, The Songs of Stephen Foster. The CD includes songs written between 1848 and 1862 and performed by such varied musicians as John Prine, Mavis Staples, Roger McGuinn, and Yo-Yo Ma. Music critic Milo Miles has a review.
The Camptown ladies sing this song, do-da, do-da. The Camptown racetrack's 5 miles long, oh, do-da-day. They long-tailed filly and a big black horse, do-da, do-da. They fly and they trek and they both cut across, oh, do-da-day. Going to run all night, going to run all day. I bet my money on the bobtail neck, somebody bet on the bay.
When I was in grade school more than 40 years ago, Stephen Foster was the really old-time American songwriter we learned about. Modern vernacular music was unknown to us. Today, it's nearly the reverse, though people invariably pick up some Foster tunes. Camptown Races, Oh Susanna, Beautiful Dreamer, maybe Old Folks at Home, Swanee River, and usually Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair, though that didn't become popular until the 1940s, nearly 80 years after Foster's death. The switch in Foster's fortunes is easily explained. Too many of his songs are associated with blackface and minstrel singing. His flair for evoking African-American intonation and language helped make him the most famous songwriter in America before the Civil War. By the Civil Rights era, it was an embarrassment.
Swanee River, far, far away. That's where my heart is turning ever. That's where the old folks stay. All up and down this whole creation.
So how does one celebrate Foster in modern times? First of all, minstrel music was only part of what he wrote. In fact, he was less than comfortable with his plantation tunes, more because they were lowbrow than because of their racial implications. The Beautiful Dreamer collection deftly highlights Foster's persistent themes of death and loneliness and features outstanding obscurities like the drunkard's lament, "Comrades, fill no glass for me." And Mavis Staples delivers a radiant version of Foster's landmark social realism, "Hard Times Come Again No More."
Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears while we all sub sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis a song.
Especially in the wider context of Foster's work, the minstrel songs escape the taint of history. With all hint of nostalgia or discomfort stripped away, John Prine's My Old Kentucky Home becomes a valuable piece of history. And the one creaky ethnic humor tune, Don't Bet Money on the Shanghai, gets a properly ironic reading from BR549. For those who want to learn more about the songwriter, his times, and his legacy, Ken Emerson's liner notes here are a good start. But I also must recommend Emerson's sparkling biography, Duda, Stephen Foster and the Rise of American Popular Culture. Emerson is expert at helping you scrape away the crust of what he calls incessant repetition and parody to hear Foster as freshly as possible. Against the odds, Raul Malo works the same transformation on the title track of Beautiful Dreamer.
Beautiful dreamer, wake unto me. Starlight and dewdrops are waiting for thee. Sounds of the rude world heard in the day.
Foster's life was crumbling into alcoholic rubble when he wrote Beautiful Dreamer, less than 2 years before he died, almost broke, at 37. Malo's reading underscores the desperation under the corny trapping. He lets you detect the siren call of death and dissolution wrapped in the starlight and dewdrop fantasy. There are shadows in Foster's American Dream. It's a good time to re-explore them.
Milo Miles reviewed Beautiful Dreamer, the songs of Stephen Foster on American Roots Publishing.
Oh, the sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home. 'Tis summer, the old folks are gay. Well, the corn tops ripe and the meadows in the bloom, while the birds make music all the day. Weep no more, my lady. Oh, weep no more today. We sing one song for my old Kentucky home, for my old Kentucky home far away.
That's John Prine singing My Old Kentucky Home. Coming up, playing poker like a pro. This is Fresh Air. My next guest, Phil Gordon, could be considered a lucky man. He got into the high-tech software industry at the right time and got out of it before the high-tech crash. After retiring at age 26, he traveled the world, then somehow ended up at a poker table. This is where skill, as much as luck, takes over. Gordon took fourth place in the 2001 World Series of Poker and has won more than $1 million in competition since then. His good fortune at getting in at the right time has extended to television, which started televising poker in a more accessible way at about the same time Gordon started winning seriously. He's the expert poker analyst for the Bravo cable series Celebrity Poker Showdown, which he now co-hosts with comedian Dave Foley. His original co-host was Kevin Pollak. Gordon remarks on the odds and the odd players, as celebrities such as Martin Sheen, Jeff Gordon, and Ben Affleck play No Limit Texas Hold'em for charity. Let's hear some of the show. Phil Gordon and Dave Foley watch as Mina Suvari, Rosario Dawson, Wanda Sykes, and football player Jerome Bettis play a hand.
Mina Foley.
All right, this would be a very good time for Jerome to make a move. I'd like to see him go all in no matter what he has here. Here he goes, all in.
All in.
All right. He really doesn't have a choice.
This could save his testicular integrity. Mana's got a 2-3 suited.
Jerome raises to 1,400, all in.
I'm gonna let you stick around a little while.
Wanda folds, Jerome wins the pot.
She lays it down and lets him take the pot.
Come on, man. I knocked the brother out. They take away my NAACP card. Like that. Like black on black crime, man. I can't do that.
I asked Phil Gordon which celebrities surprised him by actually being good poker players.
Probably the most surprising celebrity would be Mimi Rogers. Mimi came on the show, and we were in the dressing room, and I get about two and a half hours with the players before the show actually begins to answer their questions, to practice, to make sure that they understand the mechanics of the game, and really to, you know, to play a little practice tournament. We sit down and I play some hands along with them. I play some hands against them. And Mimi, who is an extremely intelligent woman, asked probably the most detailed and insightful questions about poker that I'd ever heard. And she caused me to think about the game in some different ways. Since then, she's gone on to actually finish in the money at a World Poker Tour event. She came in 26th place at a tournament in San Jose, California in March. And she's been playing quite a bit and really improving her game. But
wow,
she was most surprising.
Has anybody else from the show that you know gone on to do that well in a real tournament?
Well, I mean, the best example is Ben Affleck. And I get a lot of questions about Ben. Ben is a world-class poker player. He may not have been a year ago, but he has taken lessons from some of the best poker players in the world. Howard Lederer, good friend of mine, Chris Ferguson, Annie Duke. He and Annie Duke are very, very good friends. And he's taken the game extremely seriously. About 2 months ago, he entered a $10,000 buy-in tournament in Commerce Casino here in Los Angeles, and he won $360,000. Ben Affleck is the California State Poker Champion right now. So he is not a person that you want to sit across the poker table from if you're expecting to win money.
I enjoy the show not only for the poker, but for the humor, because there's usually a couple of comics that are sprinkled among the table, and then there's everything from country music stars to NASCAR drivers, people that you wouldn't expect to naturally be funny, but that are really funny in this situation, and use it as a weapon.
Right,
so,
yeah.
So watching it from your analyst's booth, who's really good at using his or her own personality in a poker context?
I think there are two that come to mind. David Cross has played on our show twice. He's actually advanced to the championship round in both of his appearances on the show. One of the funniest guys in the world, and you never know what's going to come out of his mouth. And I think people sitting at the table there are just kind of waiting in anticipation for him to go crazy at the table. And they might play a suboptimal game because of that. The other one that really comes to mind is Wanda Sykes. And Wanda was at the same table in, I think, our funniest show to date with Jerome Bettis. He's a running back for the Steelers. Also Travis Tritt was at that table, country music star. And they were just so funny. I don't know. They such great chemistry at that table. Travis Tritt, gave it back to him. And poor Jerome Bettis, boy. I would not have wanted to be him in that Pittsburgh Steeler locker room for opening, for spring training, because, Wanda Sykes bluffed him out of a couple of really big pots, and yeah, wow.
Yeah, that's the
what
thing.
What a great game, though. That was so much fun for us.
I didn't think about that. When you're a celebrity player on that, you don't know until you get home and see the tape what everybody else knows about
right.
how you were suckered out.
That's right.
Well, for the Fresh Air audience, if there are people who haven't seen the show and haven't played poker, explain as concisely as you can exactly what game it is everybody's playing, why that's the game that's being played, and why what makes it so dramatic as you play it.
Sure. The game that's played on nearly every poker broadcast, including Celebrity Poker Showdown, is No Limit Texas Hold'em. This is a poker game where each player at the table is dealt two cards face down, and then there's a round of betting. And then there are three community cards turned face up in the middle of the table, followed by another round of betting. Another card face up in the middle of the table. That's called the turn card. Another round of betting. And then a final community card in the middle. So five cards in the middle, two cards in your hand. You make your best five-card hand from any combination therein. So you can use two from your hand and three from the board.
Mm-hmm.
You can use one from your hand, four from the board, or all five cards on the board if need be. We call it No Limit. So that's Texas Hold'em. The No Limit comes from the fact that at any point in the betting, you can bet as many chips as you have in front of you. And that triggers the key phrase that's penetrated the lexicon of America, I'm all in, which means you're betting all of your chips in front of you. And the reason that we play that game is because in 1979, the very first World Series of Poker that happened in Las Vegas at Benyon's Horseshoe Casino, that's the game that they played. It's considered the most skillful game in poker right now. And the tradition of having the World Series of Poker event be No Limit Texas Hold'em, I think, is carried over. All the big events on the World Poker Tour are No Limit. Celebrity Poker Showdown's No Limit. And the World Series of Poker is still No Limit.
Celebrity Poker Showdown is Bravo's most popular show, except for Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, unless you've lapped them recently.
We've lapped them.
You have lapped them? You are
it is official.
Okay,
yes.
All right. Well, congratulations. I wouldn't have bet against that one. How did you get involved? Because you didn't win the tournament in 2001. You came in fourth, and yet the guys who came in, the men or women who came in third, second, and first, aren't the co-host of this thing.
Yeah, well, fortunately, the guy that came in first only speaks Spanish. So he's Carlos Mortensen. He's from Madrid, Spain. And, we cater to an English-speaking audience mostly. So that I had that going for me. Right after my performance of the World Series of Poker, the World Poker Tour started that next year. I got very fortunate and won the third event on the World Poker Tour, which, kind of backed up my previous results. About that same time, I was invited to a double date weekend in San Francisco, and the girl that I was dating, her best friend.
Oh, I thought this was some poker game I didn't know about.
No,
okay,
all right. No.
Okay.
Her best friend was dating Hank Azaria, and Hank Azaria, as you know from The Simpsons and Birdcage and such, has a home game every Sunday night at his house in Hollywood. And Matthew Perry plays, and Michael Vartan from Alias plays, and Josh Molina from The West Wing. He plays Will Bailey on The West Wing. He's also on Sports Night and a couple of other shows.
So the Josh Molina that is one of the executive producers on your show is the same Josh Molina who's on The West Wing now?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, the same guy. One of the nicest guys in the world, by the way.
And it explains why so many West Wing players have been on,
there you go.
Your program.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, over the course of this weekend, Hank said, my friends Josh and Andy Newman, another executive producer, have been tossing around this idea. I think you'd be perfect to host it. Can I get you in touch with them? I was like, oh, sure, no problem. And Josh took me to breakfast about a week later, and pitched the show. And my first reaction was, well, how much do I have to pay to be the host of the show? And they said, no, that's not how it works in TV. We're actually going to pay you. I said, well, all the better. So, about 9 months later, they had sold the show to Bravo. And October of last year, we were filming our very first episodes. And there I was sitting behind a desk with my co-host, Kevin Pollak, and talking about poker to a national audience. It's really kind of a crazy thing to happen.
Now, you took a big risk because, in college you were studying computer science, right? You were
going
to be a software engineer. What did you want to be?
I was a software engineer.
Okay, so what did you want to be? How did you envision yourself at the age you are now when it was 10 years ago? What did you think you'd be doing?
I probably would have thought I would still be in computer software. But I got very, very lucky. I moved to California in 1991, and Northern California, Silicon Valley area, just at the right time. I got involved with a startup company. I was the first employee for a high-tech startup company called Netsys Technologies. And, over the course of 3.5 years, we built our business and built some software, very esoteric software that was only useful for probably 100 or 250 companies in the world. But it was useful enough that Cisco Systems decided to buy us out. And at age 26, I could retire. And I did so. For a couple of years, I left Silicon Valley. I left my job. And I set off on a backpacking journey around the world by myself. I visited 50 countries on 6 continents just with a backpack and hanging out, staying in youth hostels and seeing the world in a very unique way. Only when I got done with that trip and moved back to the United States did I really take up poker full-time as a profession. And I did that mostly because it was the most fun thing that I could think to do.
Bill Maher, on his program a couple weeks ago, I don't know if you heard his new rule regarding televised poker, but
no.
He said that basically anyone who watches card games on TV either needs a life or needs a drinking problem. And I wonder what your response was to that.
Well, all I can tell Bill is that he obviously hasn't played the game, because once you've played the game even once, you'll be addicted and you'll want to play and you'll want to get better. So I hope to see him at a table pretty soon. Maybe we'll get him to play on Celebrity Poker Showdown. Change his mind.
Phil Gordon, thanks very much for coming on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure.
Phil Gordon, he's the expert poker analyst on the Bravo TV series Celebrity Poker Showdown. Coming up, John Powers on the rise of political blogs. This is Fresh Air. The last few weeks have been marked by the controversy surrounding documents in a 60 Minutes report on President George W. Bush's service in the Air National Guard. But the enduring story, says critic-at-large John Powers, is not the fact that documents by National Guard Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Killian were forged, but who did the exposing.
Earlier this week, Dan Rather apologized for using bogus documents about President Bush's National Guard service. Some commentators treated this as evidence of the decline of CBS, if not of all network news. Others viewed it as an inglorious coda to the long saga of Gunga Dan, the one network anchor who's always yearned to be the conscience of America, like Walter Cronkite. Of course, these days, nobody gets to be Uncle Walter, except maybe Auntie Oprah. We live in a fragmented culture where 10,000 media outlets bloom. And while Rathergate was humiliating for Rather, it was a glorious triumph for the political blogs, which is short for weblogs. It wasn't media titans who first challenged the authenticity of the Killian documents. The first doubts came from conservative blogs with colorful names like Free Republic and Little Green Apples. Their arguments rippled outward, forcing the big media outlets to look again at evidence they would have otherwise ignored. The night CBS admitted it had been duped, you could hear the high fives echoing through the blogosphere. And rightly so. In the years since Matt Drudge first broke the Monica Lewinsky story, blogs have sprouted like mushrooms in a rainforest. They've gone from being the handiwork of bored, lonely, or troubled souls, nearly all of them male, to a new form of political expression. They are so focused, timely, and linked to real information that they make the Sunday morning pundits seem like stumps in the petrified forest. These days, many blogs are written by brainy, tireless, ideologically driven people engaged in asymmetrical warfare with the established media outlets. Lacking the resources of big news organizations, they seemingly get up each morning bent on unearthing a biased headline, demonstrating that the New York Times is too liberal or too right-wing, or tearing apart a news story that bugs them. The best sites cast a hard-burning light on stories the official media have ignored or mishandled. For instance, Trent Lott's fall from power was directly due to bloggers such as Josh Marshall and Andrew Sullivan. And the mainstream media know it. Today's internet stars have huge followings among those who make and cover the news. Bloggers like Daily Kos or Instapundit are vastly more powerful than they'd be if they merely wrote traditional columns in daily papers. Like a fulcrum, what they write now moves other people's columns. Nowadays, I don't simply read the morning papers, but check in with the blogs to see what stories have the blogosphere humming. Of course, like most things on the internet, blogs range from the exhilarating to the depressing. For every intelligent site like Kaus Files or Atrios, there are dozens of web pages dedicated to the bloggeria of small-souled nitpicking and ideological hatchet jobs, sometimes by political operatives pretending to be ordinary citizens. Too many blogs simply blame George W. Bush or the liberals for everything that goes wrong in America. Some shriek gotcha at tiny factual errors in articles written on short deadlines by people who actually have to leave the house to do their work. You see, most bloggers are critics and collators, not reporters. They don't so much dig up new information as pore over the information others have dug up, and then give internet links so you can read the things for yourself. Because blogging is relatively new, there's still a lot of insecurity about being taken seriously. And boringly enough, bloggers tend to boast about the power of blogging as relentlessly as hip-hop stars praise their own sexual prowess. But that's just a quibble. Although I myself work in print and am far too lazy to have a blog of my own, I must say that American political culture is far better for this explosion of lively new voices. The blog world has changed the structure of authority in American journalism. It has subverted the almost priestly power once claimed by the major newspapers and networks. Just as Martha Stewart helped bring stylish design to the masses, so cyberspace has democratized political commentary and media criticism. Now anybody can make like George Will, Chris Matthews, or Bill Moyers. And if they're smart, funny, or ideologically fervent enough, they will win readers far more devoted to their blogs than they are to the nightly news of the daily papers. And now and again, they may even get a famous anchorman who makes 100 times what they do, say he's sorry in front of the whole world.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and author of the new book, Sore Winners. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Joan Tui Westman. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback The Lord is My Shepherd by Harold Kushner, author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, baseball's all-time hit leader Pete Rose. He was banned from the game since 1989 for his gambling habit. Now there's an ESPN telemovie about Rose called Hustle. It's a chronicle of the baseball great's later troubled years. Join us for the next Fresh Air.